Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Leo Laporte, episode 21, Avi Bryant and Seaside.
Sorry.
We're having way too much fun, folks. Time for Floss Weekly. Randall Schwartz is here, the Pearl expert, who has been bringing us some very interesting guests of Floss Weekly. How are you, Randall? You haven't been on a cruise in ages. What's going on here?
I have not been on a cruise in what feels like 6 months, because it is 6 months. I'm actually on a cruise coming up in a couple of weeks, maybe a week or so by the time this podcast goes out. But
One, too, and I'm jealous because I would love to be on this one. This is the Panama Canal cruise, and Parallel. This is one of the Geek Cruises. Now, what did Neil rename Geek Cruises to?
It's called Inside Cruises, and that Inside. Just doesn't roll off the tongue like Geek Cruises, so it's not going to be very good. But we just added to our list Richard Dreyfuss, the actor, is
You're
coming
kidding.
Along with us.
Oh, yeah, so my God. Now, is he there for the Shakespeare path track? Or
he's... He's there because he wanted to be on the cruise, and we said, well, can you speak to something? And he said, sure. It's his 60th birthday, I think, next week, and so he wanted to take a cruise.
Wow.
So and now I had the big suite until
Richard showed up. Yeah.
So I'm sleeping on the deck. There's nothing left, so I'm going to be out on the deck in a little pup tent because I gave up my room for Richard Dreyfuss. So that's
not so bad. But that, boy, you know, it's too late to sign up, folks, but see, this is why you should sign up for the next Geek Cruise, because they're just so much fun.
I'm going to have to get him to say that there's no boating accident, at least once.
Yeah. Is that from Jaws?
Jaws, yes, it's line from Jaws. I have to get
him to say that. Boating accident! Let's go get the Jaws!
Oh, I love Richard Dreyfuss. That will be really fun. For some reason, he seems like a Mac guy. He'll probably be there for Mac Mania.
He has talked about his iPhone and about wanting to do Mac stuff. Well, he did the voice for that. The people are different. The things different. The think different ads.
He did
the voice.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, next, Jeff Goldblum, and then you got a hat trick.
Exactly. We'll get them all.
So enjoy the Panama Canal cruise next week. That means we'll be taking a little time off for Floss Weekly, but I think in a good cause. You come back and you tell us about Richard Dreyfuss. And by the way, there is a good podcast, Geek Cruises News, that Randall does, if you want to find out more about it.
Podcast.geekcruises.com. Podcast.geekcruises.com. Check it out.
Yep. Now, who are we going to talk about, or talk with, I should say, this week?
Let's just talk about a person instead. Yes. No. Avi Bryant is the creator of the Seaside framework. Now, I'm going to seem like a heretic here because our very last podcast, I was raving about Catalyst, the Perl-based framework that was supposed to basically be the equivalent of the Perl world of Ruby on Rails. Well, we're going to step another 45 degrees off in a different direction and say, let's look at the Smalltalk equivalent of building a web application framework. Now, I came about this because in the time since we did the last podcast even, I have bumped into some friends of mine who were really, really big into Smalltalk and Seaside, and Seaside being the name of the framework. And it suggested to me that I might want to take a look at that for doing my web app development. And I did, and I am excited about it, and it works really, really well. I'm sure we're going to get into some of that in this show about really what makes it different from, say, a traditional Perl-based or Ruby on Rails-based application and how it actually builds and everything. And maybe we'll also look at some of the things about how Smalltalk is actually different than other languages as well.
Well, let's get Avi on the line here and start talking to him. About Squeak and Seaside. Well, hello, Avi. Welcome. It's good to have you on Floss Weekly, monthly, nightly, yearly, whatever this show.
Floss something.
I'm glad to be here wherever I am.
Where are you?
In Vancouver, actually.
Oh, I'm going up there next week.
Excellent.
Is that where you're normally located? Is that where you're from?
It is, yeah. That's where I'm based. Yeah.
So we talked last week about a web framework for Perl. Called Catalyst, actually last time. I don't know if it was exactly last week. But then Randall got a job that involved using Seaside. And all of a sudden, Randall's like, IMing me, you got to try this thing. This is the greatest thing. I love this thing. In fact, I think, I hope I'm not talking out of school, but Randall, didn't you say you might even start using Smalltalk Squeak instead of Pearl?
Pearl? I actually, one of my things that I've been doing, and I really want to have Avi talk about this, is just, it's really been a pleasure to first go back to Smalltalk, because I knew Smalltalk long before
I ever. Is that where you started?
Well, it depends what you mean by start. I knew Smalltalk almost immediately after it was released. I got to use it on the Technotronics Magnolia back in 1982.
Oh my God.
So that's way back in the early days, as far as I'm concerned, of my computing experience. And, so it's kind of fun now to go back and actually, you know, I've been tracking Squeak since the entire time it's been out. And, now to actually come back and do web development with Smalltalk has just been a very good intersection of things. And
I don't know if you were on coffee or what, but you wrote, and this is on IM, about 10 pages about how great this thing was.
Yes, well, I'm kind of that way. Well, let's find out from Avi exactly what makes it so good, though.
First, before we do that, yes. Smalltalk, Squeak, how are they related?
So Smalltalk is a programming language, and it's as Randall, you know, mentioned, he was using it in 82. It's quite a venerable programming language. It was really the first sort of mainstream object-oriented language, and a lot of the ideas that are in sort of popular object-oriented languages today, like Java or C#, or especially languages like Ruby, came really out of Smalltalk. And for a long time, Smalltalk was only really available from very expensive commercial implementations, and Squeak was an open source implementation of Smalltalk that came out of Apple, I don't know, Randall, maybe in the mid-90s sometime.
Well, it came out when Dan and Alan left Apple to go to Disney.
Right. So it's had this sort of strange history of starting out as a project inside Apple, and then for a while was funded by Disney, for a while was funded by HP, you know, now sort of associated a little bit with the One Laptop Per Child project. So it just kind of gets funders and gets collaborators wherever it can. The main open source implementation of Smalltalk, the language, is Squeak.
So if you're using it, you're probably going to be using Squeak.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of people that use the commercial Smalltalk. So there's Syncom, VisualWorks, there's Gemstone Smalltalk. There's a few commercial Smalltalks out there. But certainly in the open source world, Squeak is the one to use.
And you can, by the way, you can get a Squeak virtual machine. So it makes it very easy to run it.
Yeah. So one of the nice things about Squeak is that it is it's extremely portable. So you can run Squeak, you know, on Windows, on Mac, on Linux. But people also have run it on PlayStation, on you know, the Acorn machines, on, you know, lots of little devices. So it's this virtual machine that really abstracts out everything about the underlying operating system. I mean, down to the, you know, it draws all its own windows and handles all its own, you know, menus and stuff, which makes for what I'll call an interesting experience for people when they first come to it, because it's really very different working in that environment from working, say, in a native macOS or Windows application. But it does mean that you can really be on any kind of computing platform out there, and it'll feel exactly the same.
That's and not cool. only that, but I can, for example, develop stuff on my Mac laptop and have what's called an image, which is the collection of the entire support infrastructure plus my particular application that I want to run. And I can move that directly with one rsync command up to my OpenBSD machine, and I'm guaranteed that it works exactly the same there, even though they're two entirely different VMs, one that interprets it on my Mac and one that interprets it on the OpenBSD machine.
So when you install Squeak on a machine, you don't install it as an application on a machine.
You install two parts. You install a VM, which will run any image, and then you start with a image that you download.
Right.
Which
so it's preferable to use it in a virtual machine, in other words.
Yes.
Okay. But we're not talking about VMware or Parallels virtual machine. It's its own virtual machine.
No, although in some ways, that's right. Yeah, it's its own virtual machine, but it feels very much like using, I mean, if people are familiar with VMware, because you sort of have this mini computer, and at any point you can just freeze exactly the state that it's in, save that out to disk, and then send that to someone, and they bring it up, and they'll be back, you know, precisely where you were, right? And if it was in the middle of running some process, that process will just keep going.
Really?
So it never happened.
Wow.
And this is great for developing server software, because, you know, I develop on a Mac, as do actually most people I know, and then we, you know, always deploy on Linux or FreeBSD or whatever boxes, but you know, you can get it set up just exactly right, dump out this image, and then upload it to the server, and away it goes.
And it's a small download. It's a 14 megabyte download for the Mac. I mean, I just downloaded it, in fact, by accident. I clicked it, and I didn't realize it was downloading it, but it did it like that. So now what you've got the VM, and you're running Squeak. Does Seaside come with that?
It depends on what you download. So yeah. If it's not installed already, it's a couple of clicks away to install it. There's sort of a package loader, and that'll bring it in. But yeah, I mean, Seaside is a separate thing. It's a framework that runs on top of Smalltalk, and it's actually been ported to all of the Smalltalks now. So you can use it with Squeak. You can also use it on pretty much any of the commercial Smalltalks. You know, those vendors keep up to date ports available. But yeah, and it's you know, a lot of the people that use Squeak are using it for you know, writing games or, you know, stuff that's on a desktop machine. But Seaside is really the way to be using Smalltalk to write web applications.
For servers, yeah. So just out of curiosity, if I write something in Squeak, can I make a standalone app, or do I have to distribute a VM with it?
Yeah, you'd be distributing two files. You'd be distributing the VM, which is the application, and the image file, which is basically the data file that
actually has. So the VM is kind of like a runtime for it.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Yeah.
So, Randall, what was it that was making you so hot?
Well, for one thing, traditional web applications, including when we were talking about Catalyst last time, it put you in the problem of having to face what to do between hits. So you get a web hit comes in, and you have to figure out what state you're in. Oh, this is the first time we're going to paint this form on the screen. And you end up coming up with names for each of the form fields, and maybe you have a little bit of server-side information that you record about the particular hit about, oh, this is user John Jameson coming in, and he's going to eventually fill out the form and contact us back with the filled-in fields. So you have a little bit of server-side information, but mostly you're painting an empty form on the client side. Now, that gets spit out to the browser, and then some infinite amount of time later, because computers go fast, so you know, what seems like an interminable amount of time later, of course, the user fills out the form and says, go. That comes in as another hit, and now you have to figure out, okay, this hit was related to the previous hit, and which hit was that? Oh, this is John Jameson again. I can tell by some magic secret field I put somewhere. And here are his fields, and now I'll have to add that. Oh, he mistyped the phone number. Now I have to repaint the entire form again with a little red box by the phone number.
You're saying saving state is tough.
Saving state is tough, and so you end up, but you have to end up writing your application as, I'm getting a hit. Now what do I do with it? You know, I'm getting the response from some browser or the initial page from some browser. What do I do with it? And a lot of the work is figuring out where you actually are in the interaction, the web application. What Seaside does is, through continuation-based programming, you get to write that as you would write a normal piece of software, like step one, step two, step three, and it all stays right next to each other in the code. And because of the way that Squeak or Smalltalk in general can save that away, thanks to some of the cool stuff that Avi and the guys did with Seaside, when the next hit comes in, the stuff that you can't see that's transparent brings you right back into the middle of your code, not at the beginning of some step again, but in the middle of your code. So now you can do step two or step three. So is that a good way to describe it?
Some kind of weird threading, state threading kind of almost.
Yeah, I mean, I like to talk about, you know, a huge amount of the work, and sort of anyone that's done web development, I think, can identify with this. A huge amount of the work in web development is in finding ways to first represent everything about where you are in the program in a URL or in hidden form fields, and then later pulling all of that identical information back out of it and reconstructing what you were doing, what state your application was in. And what Seaside does is says, well, that's ridiculous. That's a waste of time. We're just going to remember it on the server.
Of course.
And really just, you know, find some way to give that state some kind of randomly generated meaningless number or something, and that can go back and forth out to the web browser. But we don't have to spend all the time. I mean, if you look at a URL in a usual web application, it'll have, you know, oh, and page number is 3, and search term is this, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you have to, as a web developer, make sure that all of the URLs you're doing encode all of that information, and then when you get a request for that URL, you have to parse it all out again. And really, that's just something the server could be remembering. So people have, I mean, the cost of that is that you do have to store that information somewhere on the server, and that eats up a little bit of memory on the server, and that people look at your URLs and they can't necessarily understand them, which sort of offends some people aesthetically. But from the point of view of a programmer, it's this real luxury to not have to be constantly thinking about marshaling all this stuff into text and then parsing it back out again.
The other thing that Seaside really lets you do well is not have to come up with a name for a param. I tell you, I can't believe how many times I've sat down and went, okay, this is address, this is city, this is state. Oh, I've got two of those. This is work_address, this is home_address. Have to come up with all that stuff. What Seaside does is you say in your Smalltalk code, I have a text field here. I don't care what it gets named, and Seaside names it for me. And whatever randomly generated thing comes out of that, when the hit comes back in, Seaside knows exactly where to associate that param name back with my data. And I say, and when it comes in, put it into this Smalltalk variable for me. And I'm done, and I didn't have to come up with names.
And, you know, that sounds like a lazy thing, right? I mean, that sounds like, you know, oh, you don't want to, you know, think of what the name is already, right? But there are actually some places where it makes a huge difference. So, for example, let's say that you've built a form that has those names, like you were saying, address, you know, first name, last name. Let's say later on you decide you want to have two of those forms on the same page. Well, you can't reuse the same code because all of your code is expecting that to say first name, last name, address, and now your second form is going to have to, you know, call them first name 2, last name 2, address 2, whatever, something like that. So now you have to figure out how to make your code deal with, well, it could be the one, it could be the other. In Seaside, when you're letting the framework pick all of the names for those forms and just generally manage that interaction, then you can use exactly the same code and repeat that form, let's say, as many times on the page as you want, and it will all kind of just work because you're not thinking about things globally. You're not thinking about building this one big master URL or form submission and parsing it in a global way. You're just thinking at this very local level of, I want to create this form field. Here's what I want to happen with this form field, and it takes care of all the plumbing.
Now, when it comes time to run this Squeak application on a web server, can I do it with Apache? Do I have to run some special web server? How do I move this web app over?
So Squeak has a web server in it, and this is actually pretty similar to the way people normally deploy Ruby on Rails apps too, which is you know, you have either a Ruby web server or a Squeak web server, which is running your application, and then you'll probably have Apache sitting in front of that, and Apache will know to direct certain requests back to the Squeak web server, and other requests for, you know, just static image files or something, it'll take care of itself. So it's not like it's a module that plugs into Apache, but it is usually the case that you'll have Apache sitting in front and just redirecting some of the requests back to it.
Apache will use some sort of proxying commands to basically pass it.
Exactly.
That makes sense, yeah. I have to say, I opened up this Squeak image. It's so cool. It looks like just kind of a fun little environment. What a great way to, for instance, teach people to program. Is it? I guess it could be used that way, yes?
Squeak, yeah, and actually Squeak, well, Smalltalk is a language originally, and Squeak specifically was designed as a way to teach people to program. So there's, in Squeak, there's this layer called eToys, which is really sort of a drag-and-drop kind of tile-based programming environment on top of the sort of Smalltalk syntax that you or I would use, which does get used in classrooms to teach kids how to program, and it's a great thing. You know, one thing that I think is really neat about Smalltalk is that when you try to boil something down to something that's simple and elegant enough for children to grasp and be productive with, it turns out to actually be really great and productive for everyone else to use too. And I think that's kind of neat.
And one thing that's where the eToys is used is in this one laptop per child. So that's actually
included
one of these OLPCs that are going on.
Oh, you're kidding.
Well.
Really?
Now, this is all part of OLPC as well, the eToy stuff. And what's great is that they can start out by programming in what's called a tile-based environment. You know, move car forward by one unit, turn it right one unit during every
kind of like Alice or something.
And build like a circle or something. But when you want to get down inside the machine, the nice thing about Smalltalk and Squeak in particular is that everything from top to bottom is in Smalltalk, so you can even figure out how it's drawing that on the screen and change that if you want.
Wow.
It's all malleable, all completely changeable, which is really, really nice. That speaks more to Smalltalk than it does to like the Seaside Project or anything that Avi's doing. But yeah, it's definitely really worth getting into. Now, that image you downloaded also has a full speech synthesizer, MIDI sequencer, IRC client, web browser.
Wow.
What else does it have in there, Avi? It's just everything.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, it's a ton of stuff. There's this real culture of in Smalltalk of just doing everything in Smalltalk as deep as possible, as portable as possible, not relying on any kind of external C libraries or anything. And so, you know, I have to say, when I'm doing web development, you know, sometimes I use the built-in Smalltalk implementation of stuff, and sometimes I'll just call out to, you know, a Ruby script that might do it more conveniently, calling to a library. But yeah, it's really the richness and depth of that stuff is there, and that's really what drew me to the Smalltalk community was that there was this, you know, 25 years of history of building stuff and really of building stuff in an open source way. I mean, there's a culture of having the source always available. And you know, you get a language like Ruby, which is very exciting and has a lot of momentum around it right now, but it just doesn't have that depth. It doesn't have those years of implementation sort of refining and polishing that people have put into it that Smalltalk does.
Now, what brought you to Seaside? What's the history of that? And were you involved from the beginning, or how does it come about?
Yeah, so Seaside was a project that I started. I had actually originally, I was interested in web frameworks, and I'd seen some interesting web frameworks like Next's WebObjects framework. I mean, this was years ago. Was a really fascinating framework, but I wanted something. So WebObjects was originally an Objective-C, which is now what's, you know, used everywhere in Mac OS X. And I wanted something in a sort of lighter, more dynamic language, and so I turned actually to Ruby. And this was in the days before Ruby on Rails. There really wasn't a whole lot going on with web development around Ruby, but Ruby was an interesting language, and I started working on a framework and actually gave a talk at the very first Ruby conference on this web framework that I'd written, which was called Iowa. And at that same conference, so there was the Ruby conference, and right after that was Uppsala. And I happened to be giving a talk at Uppsala on some research that I'd been doing that happened to be sort of Java academic stuff. And Uppsala, just to push something else on the stack, Uppsala sort of was originally a very Smalltalk-dominated conference. It's an object-oriented, it's kind of the main academic object-oriented conference. And it used to be where all the Smalltalkers would gather. And over the years, as Java became more of kind of a mainstream language, it got taken over more and more by talks on Java and maybe C#. But all the Smalltalkers kept coming, and they didn't even bother to register for the conference necessarily. They'd just sit in the hallways, you know, bring their own projector, have their own set of talks.
I
thought this was so cool. And really, you know, compared to, I mean, including my talk, compared to all of the Java talks that were going on, the stuff that was going on in that little kind of, you know, underground Smalltalk conference in the hallways there was so much cooler than anything else I'd seen. And so I sort of made a decision basically on the plane back to Vancouver, you know, okay, I'm gonna try taking all the work I've been doing in Ruby and do that in Smalltalk instead.
Oh, interesting. So you really had started in Ruby and Ruby on Rails environment.
Well, not Rails, because Rails, this was long
pre-Rails.
Before
okay.
This was long before Rails existed. But yeah, in Ruby, and Ruby is really has a lot of similarities to Smalltalk, but doesn't have quite the elegance, quite the purity of Smalltalk, which matters to some people, but actually, you know, it makes a practical difference too. But also, really, just doesn't have all of the history and the tools. I mean, the debugger in Smalltalk, the environment in Smalltalk, the class browsers and the ability to be productive in that environment for me was much greater than I ever was in Ruby, and so I really never looked back, and I started you know, just building a framework to do some consulting projects that I had, and it really just took off from there.
Ruby has at least the advantage, though, of looking a little bit like a procedural language.
It does, yeah. Ruby is much more familiar to people that come from other languages, partly because it uses all the same kind of standard Unix tools. You know, you use a text editor, you use CVS or whatever to manage your source. You grep through your, I mean, everything that people are used to doing. And Smalltalk, really, it's this whole different, because it's in this virtual machine and this environment, it's this whole different world. And it's really hard for people to get used to it.
Yeah, I'm looking for the command line in the VM, and I don't see it. Where's the command line?
Exactly.
Open a workspace.
I got a workspace open. Yeah, but you know what? It's fun to play with. It's kind of interesting.
It is. Yeah. It is.
I mean, you have painting tools in this thing.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
There's everything in there. And a lot of the other thing that, well, the reason I gave it a chance, really, the reason I didn't just run away screaming when you know, it wasn't what I was used to, was that I was becoming aware of all of these threads of things that I was interested in, like wikis and, you know, at the time, extreme programming and, well, object-oriented programming generally and say, Objective-C and Ruby in particular, and even sort of the, you know, the Mac Windows and Menus interface. And if you just draw a line back from all of these things, they all kind of intersect at Smalltalk, because a lot of those ideas really originated and were developed from the original Smalltalk work. And, right. And so it's... you know, it's on the one hand this very practical, useful modern tool, and on the other hand, it's this fascinating historical artifact.
Would you develop a production web tool using Smalltalk, or is it more for prototyping?
I do, and C-Side. I have. Okay. Yeah, I mean, so
I know that's a leading question. But.
Yeah, exactly. Gee, well, what do I do for a living? Yeah, so I run a startup called DabbleDB, and everything we do is built in C-Side, in Smalltalk, wow. and right now deployed on top of Squeak.
So I go to, sure. What's the website, DabbleDB?
DabbleDB, DabbleDB.com.
Okay. And everything there, if I go there, I'm running on C-Side.
That's right, yeah.
On Squeak.
On Squeak.
On Squeak.
Now, how many Squeak instances do you have? How do you have that worked out? That must be crazy for scaling.
There are, yeah, so it's a little funny the way it works. Basically, every customer gets their own Squeak VM.
Wow.
And so there are, you know, tens of thousands of Squeak images sitting on that server, and potentially tens of thousands of Squeak VMs. Now, most of the time, most of them aren't running because most people aren't using the app at the same time. But however many people are using the app, there are that many VMs running. And so it's kind of neat because everybody gets their own isolated little environment. We can, in theory, make changes to, you know, just one customer's copy of the application and not anyone else's. Although in practice, of course, we tend to roll out changes to almost everyone at once. So that's how it works. And so it's really easy to load balance. I mean, we have however many servers we need to support the number of concurrent VMs that are running.
Now, I have to make a confession. I was a little disingenuous since Avi has, in fact, been on the TV show talking about DabbleDB.
It's true.
But I don't even know if that's aired yet. I guess it has. Has it aired yet?
Somebody told me it had.
Okay,
I haven't
good.
Actually
right.
seen it.
We did it a couple of months ago, so I'm sure by now it has aired. And I was blown away by DabbleDB. I mean, it's very cool. In fact, I set up an account right away, and I've been dumping data into it.
Excellent.
Yeah. So when you use DabbleDB, you don't know you're using Squeak or Smalltalk or anything like that, but is the kind of the ease of use and the way that DabbleDB works influenced by Squeak?
Yeah, and you can kind of take that on a couple of levels. I mean, one thing is that people, the most common reaction, not for end users, which is sort of who we target, but for developers who see DabbleDB is...
They go, wow.
I don't understand how you did that.
How'd you do that?
Yeah. That does not make sense. I credit that, you know, partly really to C-Side and to Smalltalk, that it allowed us to build a much more complex... I mean, DabbleDB is an extremely complex web application. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to think it's an extremely sophisticated web application.
But it hides all of that because it just seems smart.
Yeah, and we couldn't have, I mean, we couldn't have done something that, I do not believe we ever would have shipped anything, you know, one-tenth that complex if we were using another environment. So that's true. And I mean, the other side of that is that I think a lot of the sort of design philosophy of Dabble was inspired by things like Smalltalk. I mean, Smalltalk is very much into direct manipulation, for example, that you're always, you know, working with your running program, your data. There's not this kind of concept that you normally have of first you write the program, then you run the program. It's kind of all happening at once. And that's really the same way a spreadsheet works, if you think about it, right? Every time you make a change to a spreadsheet, to the program of a spreadsheet, you've got all of your numbers in front of you, and you see them change instantly. And we tried to do the same kind of thing with Dabble, right? So you're not going off and kind of setting up how your database should work. What you're doing is you're just bringing in your data, and with your data in front of you every step of the way, you're changing the way it works. So that was something that's really sort of small talk inspired.
Wow.
How do I type hello world? I got a workspace open.
Let's see. Why don't you type in self space inform with a colon at the end.
Okay. So I'm telling myself.
Yeah. And then in single quotes, hello world.
Yeah.
Is that going to work in a workspace?
So, well, is self the workspace? Is that...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, self is just the current object. It's like this in some languages. I think
right.
Ruby also uses self,
right?
And then once you've got that typed in with your cursor on that line, or you can select the line. Now, this will depend if you're on a Mac or a PC, but try Command D.
To run it.
Yeah.
All right.
So what that'll do is that'll take that code and compile it and then execute it.
Very cool. It's not actually doing anything, but I'm on a Mac. Command D. I get the idea. So
yeah.
So basically, I could type basically straight code into this workspace and execute it.
Yeah, but more likely what you're going to be doing is going into a browser, a code browser that's an integrated development environment, and creating classes and creating instances of those classes and using that to actually do right. either graphics on your screen as you're interacting with it now, or in the case of Seaside, web pages and what the web right. pages do when they get hit.
When you interact with Seaside, is Seaside an object in this VM?
Seaside is many objects, yeah, many okay. interacting objects. So really, each piece of your web page is an object.
Oh, interesting. Wow, what a great way to do it.
Yeah, and that really has a lot of benefits in terms of modularity. In that, you know, it's often the case in a website that you've got some pieces of the website that really repeat themselves over and over again. So you might have some sidebar that appears on a lot of different pages.
Right.
Or you might have some kind of a, you know, paging or navigation thing. And in Seaside, what you do is you have an object that is for that little piece of the page. And these objects end up being sort of arranged in a tree that represents the whole page. But each object sort of does everything for itself. It does its own request processing. It does its own generation of the HTML. It keeps its own state, like what page it's on or you know, what sidebar link is expanded or whatever it is. And so none of these pieces, they're all separate objects, and none of them really have to know about each other or care about each other. And that means when you move them around or reuse them somewhere else, that it all just sort of just works.
This also, I think, is a pretty easy metaphor for a web developer to get used to, because this is kind of how templating works. And I mean, it's not an unfamiliar idea. It's really just making it fully object-oriented instead of kind of half-object-oriented.
Yeah, part of the advantage is that you're not jumping into a different language for your templating. And like even like my traditional work with Perl and Template Toolkit or Perl and Mason, there's like one language that does the templating and Perl that does everything else. With Seaside, what I found was that I'm templating in Smalltalk, which means I don't have to go to a different mode
right.
in my head. It's much easier to use all the Smalltalk tools to develop that and maintain that.
Which is something that people often react very strongly against, actually, because they're very used to having their template be an HTML file that they hand off to the web designer, and they sort of expect the web designer to take care of that. And in Seaside, the expectation is very much that the HTML is going to be the responsibility of the Smalltalk programmer, of the developer side of things. And to me, this is really just an acknowledgement that we've moved to really a CSS world where what the designer's doing is building a style sheet, and that's where all of the sort of aesthetic design of the page should be, and that the structural design of the page is really the developer's problem, and so it should be written with a, you know, in a programming language that has a full set of tools that programming languages should, rather than kind of a dumbed down templating language.
That makes a lot more sense, frankly.
So yeah. The developer's going to say, I've got a div and it's got this list in it, and it's a list of all the people logged in right now. Here, take this. Here's the name of the class that the div is. You add the styles to make that look pretty across the top of the page.
That's
exactly the relationship that the designer and the developer have.
That's exactly right. Yeah,
that's how it should be. Of course, that makes sense.
Yeah, but it's unbelievable how much people freak out when they realize that that's what's expected of them. And I think that'll change over time as CSS becomes sort of more and more ingrained into people's sense of what the right way of doing things is.
Well, and this promotes the semantic web too, right? I mean, this is a very natural way to do it.
Avi, do you work with a designer then, or a team of designers for DabbleDB? How does that work for you?
Yeah, there's a single full-time designer who we love, and you can't have him. Luke, he's been working with us really from the beginning, and that to me is really a key thing when you're building a web application. Is that if you don't have the designer involved from the beginning, you're sort of kidding yourself, because what you do all the time is say, oh well, this is ugly and hard to use now, but once the designer comes in and cleans it up, then it'll be great. And that's not true. If you're not building it right and designed well from the beginning, and it's just so satisfying to work on something that looks pretty while you're working on it. So that's my my one tip for any budding entrepreneurs wanting to do a web startup is your first hire should be a great modern standards compliant web designer.
Start with a CSS.
Yeah.
So you're saying that maybe something like maybe a laptop running Seaside with a Smalltalk programmer and a designer sitting at Starbucks might actually be a valid startup model.
I think that's a perfect startup model. That's pretty much how we started. The way to do it. Yeah.
It's very cool. And when you're sitting there with your virtual machine open, people are going to come over and say, "What is that? That's cool. That's kind of neat. How did you do that?" Say, well, it's just a 14 meg download here. Now, I have Squeak running, and how would I add Seaside to Squeak? You said it's a simple process of just getting it.
Yeah,
simple for us.
So, right. So I think you'd do something like you'd click on the background, if that makes sense.
Yep.
Like click on the wallpaper, sort of, and that should pop up a menu. And one of the items should be open.
Okay.
And then one of the things there should probably be Squeak Map.
All right.
And Squeak Map's kind of a package manager, like Debian's package manager or something like that.
A downloader, too. It knows to go out to the net and knows dependencies and things like that. So it's actually pretty smart.
Very cool.
And then from there, you'd find Seaside and a web server and
how would I interact with Seaside? Is it is it like working with Rails? Is it how what does it look like?
Well,
I guess
so
it's a lot of objects, right? I mean, you basically have
a
bunch
of right. So you'd subclass some classes and implement classes for the parts of your web application. And also, one thing that Seaside does have, on the one hand, you'd be writing code. On the other hand, Seaside tries to have a lot of tools running inside the web browser itself. So when you're sort of running in development mode, there's this toolbar across the bottom of the web page. And you really don't want to leave that on when you deploy your app.
that would be a bad
idea. And that'll let people do stuff like, see each object on the page, get a special outline that lets you then edit its code or inspect it. And if there's, if there's an error, you can sort of do a certain amount of debugging from within the web browser. So, I mean, on the one hand, the answer is, it's like anything else. You're writing code inside Squeak, using the classes of this framework. And on the other hand, we do try to make it, a little more integrated with kind of the web experience.
Yeah, what I really like is that when I get some problem with my code, well, excuse me, the rare time that I have a problem.
Very rare, of course.
Of course.
Rare
yes.
time I have a problem with my code. Because I'm in development mode rather than deployment mode, I get a traceback in my browser that shows me pretty much the different message sends, so the different subroutine calls, you might call it in other languages, and what the parameters were. And I get a choice of saying, ignore this or debug it. And I can hit debug in the browser, and back over in my Squeak window, up pops the traditional Smalltalk debugger.
Right.
I can drill down inside that, look at every step, look at all the details, all the objects being sent and everything like that, fix up the code right there, hit proceed, and my browser finishes that particular hit. So I don't have to start my tests all from the beginning again. I can proceed right from the middle of my development, my whatever stage I'm at in my program. It's really amazing.
Yeah, and then it gets even better when you're doing that on a live application that a customer is using, right? And you're on the phone with them. This is actually a story I stole from Paul Graham, right? But they call up and they have a problem and you're doing that and you say, what problem? There's no bug there. Just try it again. There's no bug.
You see, it's all gone. It's magic. Does Paul Graham use Seaside and Squeak?
No, he was. I mean, he used a lot of the same ideas, but in Lisp.
Yeah, okay.
That's in terms of drawing inspiration for this stuff, certainly some inspiration came from stuff Paul Graham said, some came from Next and WebObject, some came from there's some crazy Scheme web frameworks out there that really do the continuation thing a lot more than Seaside does. That's definitely one of the places some inspiration came from.
So does Seaside provide some sort of support for, like, security? Because, like, I mean, I've got my objects that I've got from my web page hits. You've got your objects. How does it keep track of all those? What's involved there?
Right. So one of the interesting things about getting rid of names, we were talking back at the beginning about how you don't name things, is that if you're not naming things, but instead the framework is just giving them these meaningless numbers, then I can't guess what your names might be. And so if I'm, if I'm maliciously trying to make your web application do things that you didn't intend it to do, it's really hard for me to do that because I'm not going to be able to guess the kind of long random numbers that the framework is generating and uses as a way to trigger events. Whereas in some other frameworks, in most web applications, if I can think, all I have to do is type, and price equals $1 instead of and price equals $20, then I'm golden. And so it's what sometimes security people call capabilities-based security, which basically means if I don't explicitly hand you something saying, here is a key that will let you unlock this, then you have no way ever of doing it. And so those numbers, those kind of meaningless long numbers that Seaside generates, those are capabilities. And if you haven't been given a capability to, say, delete an item, then you're never going to be able to ask the framework to do it.
Are those numbers cryptographically strong, or can I make that an option, or how does that work?
Yeah, they are. To be a little more specific, each page has a single number for the page that is cryptographically secure, and then different links on that page will each have a sequential number. But if you don't have that page's secure number, then the sequential links are meaningless. So.
Wow, cool, because that definitely gets around some of the issues, especially if I see these applications that do everything client-side, which of course means I turn off JavaScript and force whatever I want down their throat. So
yes.
That would really suck, definitely. Now, did you start Seaside? Is it your, like, creation, and are you still the chief maintainer or the only maintainer? How's that going?
Yeah, I did start it. So it started, a guy I was working with at the time named Julian Fitzell, and I started the first version of Seaside, and then sort of version 2 of Seaside was really me alone. And then at that time, the community really started picking up, and it especially got picked up by this group at the University of Bern in Switzerland. And it's really at this point those guys who are maintaining it. And so that's Lucas Rengli and Philippe Marchal and a few other people, but all from that same university. The recent versions of Seaside, I basically, apart from some sort of advice thrown down to them, to take or leave, basically, They've been doing all of the work, and it's been great to see that. And that for me was a real turning point when it stopped being me who was having to answer every question on the mailing list, and it stopped being me who had to commit every piece of code to this point where really I'm just a user and maybe the loudest advocate of it, but essentially just a user like everyone else.
Now it has it fits into the Smalltalk testing framework, I presume.
Yeah, there some people. So I have to confess, I do not have the testing religion. I do not write my code test first, which in the Smalltalk community gets me regularly flogged. But that's just the way it is. But yeah, certainly there are extensions to SUnit and ways to run your tests within the browser and run tests against it. And I, because I don't use them, am not very familiar with them.
Now, but you're deploying a commercial app. How scared are you that, 2.9 is going to break your commercial app?
Oh, well, I'm pretty conservative with versions. So I think we actually use 2.6. So we're a few point releases behind. But that's more a matter of laziness than fear. The nice thing about web apps is that even if there are problems with them, you know about them right away, and if you can get a fix out quick enough, it's only a tiny, tiny percentage of your users that ever actually see the problem. So obviously, it's better if you can avoid having problems at all. But I found I'm much more cavalier, frankly, about potential problems with a web application. Now, obviously, if it gets into something where there might be data loss or something, you have to be very careful. But if we're just talking about, say, UI glitches, a little more cavalier with web apps than I might be or might have been with desktop apps before, where if there's a problem, it's a disaster to roll out a new version.
Now, are you doing the sort of things internally that we hear when we talk about agile programming of like point releases that internally that come out every day or two and that kind of stuff?
It's not unheard of for us to push out a new version multiple times a day and certainly multiple times a week.
So I could log into today's DabbleDB and it would be one thing and then log in tomorrow and it's actually running different code then, huh?
Yeah, and you'll see that, actually. It takes a couple of extra seconds to come up when it's got a new version, and so you can tell if you're a Dabble user every time you see that sort of spinner that says, your database is being updated, please wait a moment. Wow. That's because we pushed out a new version, and that happens, all the time.
Wow. And now, are you familiar enough with Ruby on Rails to say compare this development speed-wise, or is that just a stupid question?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to ask about that because I've never done anything real with Rails. Rails is very tied. Rails is a great framework that uses very traditional notions of web development. So it's very tied to traditional templating. It's very tied to traditional sort of request processing and management. It's very tied to relational databases, which we don't have time for, but I'm not a big... let's say they are the choice everyone makes first when they're building a web application, and there's really only a few, a small percentage of web applications for which I think they're the best choice. So, I think within those kind of traditional enterprise-y choices that it makes, Rails is great. But if you free yourself of those choices, then I think you can do a lot better.
Wow. Very cool. Very cool. Leo?
I've just finished installing Seaside, so I'm...
He'll have his first Hello World app going any second
now.
So you
cool.
take WA component, you subclass it, you make your own class, and you install that as the top level URL. It's there's actually a great
set of tutorials
on the web.
Yeah, I got all that. I'll do that right away. I have no idea what he just said.
Great set of tutorials on the web, and I've actually gone through them only in the last 3 or 4 weeks. So I'm and yet I find myself already developing. I'm doing I'm actually rewriting Geek Cruises, who I think you're familiar with, Leo.
Yes.
I'm rewriting their booking application in Seaside, and
isn't
I've been funded
cool?
to do that.
Isn't that
and
cool?
it's just been great, and it's been so much easier. I mean, just not naming things, you wouldn't believe how much difference that makes in my development cycle. It's just crazy. I'm also using Magritte. I probably mispronounced that. Do you use that with your stuff there?
No, I don't. Yeah, but that's a cool framework. That's also from Lucas Rangley at the University of Bern. Yeah, so that's a way of sort of describing. It's kind of like what Rails does, where you describe all of the attributes of your classes, and then you can have what does Rails call it, scaffolding, where you just kind of have this auto-generated forms and things and ways of browsing them. And Magritte's kind of similar for Smalltalk, but as Smalltalkers tend to do, takes it a lot further and a lot deeper. It's a neat piece of work.
What I like about Magritte is I can say not only, let's say, this field in my data structure is the zip code, but that the zip code has to be 5 digits long. And when the submit button comes in, it automatically generates the code that says, oh, by the way, that wasn't 5 digits long, and puts up the right message in the right place. And it saves me having to rewrite that code over and over again, and I get to say everything just once.
So what's Comanche, and why do I have to install it?
it's a web server. It's the built-in web server.
Got it.
So Comanche, Apache, get it. So
I probably shouldn't start my web server here quite yet. I'll save that for later. What is great about when you have an environment that encourages play and encourages this kind of experimentation. That's great. It's one of the things I liked about Ruby. It's one of the things I like about Python is having that interpreter and being able to play with it. This kind of takes it to a whole nother level, though. I mean,
oh, it's incredible. It's been a lot of fun, and I get distracted sometimes because I'll start wondering. First I'll look at some piece of code, and then I'll see some method call that's being made, and I go, oh, I wonder how that works, and I'll start drilling down into every place in my Smalltalk image that uses that method call, and I'll go, oh, look how this is used. It's kind of like Wikipedia for code.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's something I think that's important to emphasize because it's very different from, say, Ruby or Python or the kind of traditional Unix scripting language implementation is that everything, all the libraries are right there for you in Smalltalk to browse exactly like your own code. And so whereas in Ruby, the implementation of, say, array is in some C file somewhere that's compiled into the interpreter, in Smalltalk, it's right there with the rest of your code written in Smalltalk. And that's just as an educational tool, it's so useful, and as a debugging tool too, because you can step right into every level of everything that's going on. Whereas in a more traditional scripting language, you hit this barrier where you've made this call into the standard libraries, and then you don't really know anything. It's just it's doing its thing, and I better read the documentation. And Squeak sort of takes that to an extreme because even the VM itself is written in Smalltalk, and it's written in this subset of Smalltalk, this carefully chosen subset of Smalltalk that can be translated to C for performance. But it means that if you're hacking on the VM, you're actually hacking in Smalltalk debuggers and all this to debug a simulation of the VM, which then is going to get built in C and run at speed. So it's it's turtles all the way down, which I love.
Absolutely, a lot of fun to play with. And for example, I mean, like in the equivalent, say, in the Perl world, for people listening on that listen because they speak Perl, is like it'd be like suppose you could when you're looking at a map operation, you're going, I don't understand really how map works. To be able to click on something and everything of every piece of source code ever written in the CPAN that involves the map operation came up in a window. That was it just so you have hundreds of examples of how to use it. It's like it would have saved my learning even. Yes.
Now it's very cool because the tools kind of are integrated so closely into the language that there's a natural kind of willingness to write these tools. It's part of the process.
And more than that, you can extend the tools.
And
I mean,
the
browser has gone through a number of changes over the years, including refactoring browsers and whisker browsers and all these different kinds of enhancements. And, if you say, I don't like how this is on the first menu, I wish it was on the second menu instead for my browser, you just go in and tweak it. It's just the source code's right there, and your tools change as you need it. It's like what Emacs is to text editing. Everything's malleable. Everything's changeable.
Well, we've had fun. I've had fun playing with Squeak. I got Seaside installed. Who knows what's next? Of course, a great place to go is to see this at work is DabbleDB, which is Dabble, DABBLEDB.com.
And Seaside.st for the Seaside site.
Yep. Although, really, you never really, you don't install it from the Seaside site. You install Squeak and then do it from within Squeak. But
if you go to the Seaside site, you shortcut some of the installation you're doing, I think, because you could just download an image that had it was preloaded with Seaside and Comanche and all that stuff.
Right.
So you could save yourself a little bit of work.
Yeah, and I'm still at 2.5 because I installed 2.5, so I should really I should get 2.8.
And the nice thing is that the Seaside runs the Seaside site, and it's running a content management system. Is that running Peer? Do you know if Seaside?
Yeah, it is. It's running Peer. Yeah.
So there's this great content management system, CMS, called Peer, that's built on Seaside. Get it? Peer and Seaside. Anyway, P-I-E-R. And it allows people to maintain an entire site with a layout and looks and users and things like that, all from the browser level, not writing code down inside of it, although you can do that to enhance things, but it's really a great CMS.
Yeah, I just clicked on CSS, and you can see this. Oh, this is really neat, yeah. So Peer is written in Seaside and Squeak.
Yes.
And you know, there's also this a lot of wiki stuff, it seems like. It seems to be popular.
There's a wiki written in Peer, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Very neat.
So it's a turtles all the way down.
Layers upon layers, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Very cool. Well, Avi, it's nice to talk to you again. I really appreciate
you
joining us. Sorry, I didn't recognize you at first, but as soon as you said DabbleDB, I said, oh, wait a minute. Because I was so blown away with DabbleDB. But I think a lot of what blew me away with DabbleDB, I now see, is because you could do all that with Seaside and Squeak.
It helps.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, thank you so much.
Sorry,
we were late, but I'm glad we could get you on and a somewhat different conversation than the one we had on the lab, but it all clicks together now for me and my slow brain. And I'm going to be playing with this for some time, I think.
I'm going to be getting this email from now on. Hey, how do you do this?
What do you do this with? I'm going to play with Squeak for a long time before I start getting too far down the road with Seaside.
But yeah, I can help with that too, Leo.
Yeah, it's really neat. It's really, really cool. And I think I could
do recommend having Randall sit down with you, because it's different, you know,
and
you need someone who knows it, who can just see where you're getting hung up and give you the right push. Otherwise, I've seen too many people run away screaming when they try to do it themselves.
Because it doesn't make any sense. It's like
eToy's image is downloadable. I mean, the OLPC image is downloadable from the Seaside or from the
OLPC. Is all of OLPC in that Squeak?
No.
Not all. No, a lot of it's in Python, I think.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
But the actual code that's being run on OLPC so that it can give you the eToys image and let you program is available as an image file, and you download it and you click it and it starts up in your VM that you've just downloaded.
Ah, cool.
And so that's available too. So, and that actually presents a sort of children-friendly interface, which is just about your level, Leo. So it should work out pretty well.
I think it's what I need, yeah. I need to get those eToys. So how would I do that? Would I also use the Squeak loader to do that?
No, it's on the OLPC site. You have to look around a little bit on their wiki.
Okay,
you look for OLPC, and you look for eToys image as the keywords. I think
so you download that standalone, or you download it from within Squeak?
You download that standalone, and it has a .image file that once you click on it,
then
it will launch your VM.
I got it. Very cool. Oh, yeah, because when I opened Squeak, I opened used the GUI, and then it opened this image. Got it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's really fun to play with this. Thank you, Avi.
We're just distracted him from the rest of the chat.
Yeah, no kidding. Exactly. Forget podcasts. I'm going to play with Squeak.
Yep. All right. Sounds good.
Take care. Thanks a lot.
Take care, guys.
Alrighty.
Bye-bye.
It's so funny, until he said DabbleDB, I had no, Avi Bryant's a little, that could be anybody, but now I'm going, wait a minute, I've interviewed this guy, I know who this guy is.
And I didn't know you'd interviewed him, because I'm not in Canada, so I'm not watching
the
show.
Why would you know? Yeah. No,
so I wouldn't know either. This is funny. This is a kind of a confluence of things.
And I think he mentioned that he did this in Squeak, but he didn't mention Seaside, and I didn't put two and two together, so.
You didn't read my email to you where it said DabbleDB, but that's okay.
And I didn't. Well, I didn't. I read it. I just didn't read it closely enough. Apparently, as soon as I got to the part where here's his login, I just I got everything I need.
Well, he certainly covered quite a bit of stuff. He was definitely. I love how he sort of went from Java to Objective-C over to Ruby, and finally realizing Ruby didn't cut it, and decided to hang out in the hallways. That was a great story. Yeah. That was just really incredible. And to think that open source can result from being around a real conference, but the hallway conference actually generating the kind discussion that led him to create DabbleDB and all this. This is really amazing stuff. Yeah, it was a great conversation we had with him. That's great.
Well, we thank you for joining us on Floss Weekly this week, and we do hope you will join us again next time. I think Randall's lined up some really fun stuff, and of course, all of this is leading up to the creator of Smalltalk, Alan Kay, joining us at some point, which I hope we can do.
He's agreed. We're just looking for the date, so I'm just trying to get this.
Oh, I love hearing that. Yes. That's great.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Randall, thank you for reviving the Moribund Floss Weekly, and we look forward to another one real soon.
I hope we do it soon. Thanks.